Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan, and you're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. Today we have a very awesome show, and I say this every week, but they just keep getting better. Our guest today is our Latin American expert, Ava Golinger. We'll be on the phone with Ava. She'll be in Caracas, Venezuela. Stay tuned. When we come right back, we'll be with Ava Golinger.
Cindy Sheehan's new ebook, Myth America 2, further examines two distinct classes of people that clearly show that we are not all in this together, as President Obama has declared. The first group, the robber class, are wealthy victimizers such as those corporations and politicians that profit off the hard labor of others through economic theft and violent exploitation. The second group, the robbed class, are the victims such as those who work multiple jobs just to make ends meet, those who tragically send their children off to die in robber class wars, those who lack proper health care, those who are denied decent education, and those who lose jobs and homes due to robber class graft. The robber class controls our government, and as Cindy says, we, the robbed class, can only be robbed if we allow it. With pinpoint accuracy, humor, and in layperson's terms, Cindy Sheehan shows us why we should no longer be codependent with the robber class. To obtain a copy of Myth America 2, please visit CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
I will promise you this, that if we have not gotten our troops out by the time I am president, it is the first thing I will do. I will get our troops home. We will bring an end to this war. You can take that to the bank.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm Cindy Sheehan. Our guest today is Venezuelan-American author and attorney Ava Golinger. Ava writes, her blog is Postcards from the Revolution, and she wrote a book called The Chavez Code, and her blog can be found at www.chavezcode.com. Ava, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you very much.
It's nice to have you on again, and you didn't hear my introduction of you, but I called you our expert on everything Latin American.
Thanks.
So we appreciate your time. Well, the subject today is very synchronistic with the documentary I'm making called Revolution, a Love Story, about the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela, about the grassroots uprisings all through Latin America. But we just had some very recent interesting events happen down there that I wanted to talk to you about. But before we get into the elections in Venezuela and the coup attempt last week in Ecuador, I was looking on online for some information, just kind of researching the topic, but I research it every day. And I came up across these vile criticisms of the election in Venezuela, and they were mostly on the Huffington Post. Why do you think the Huffington Post is so critical, and not just critical, but just adamantly vile against President Hugo Chavez and the Venezuelan Bolivarian Revolution?
That's actually a question I've been asking myself and wondering what's going on at the Huffington Post, because certainly there's an overwhelming amount of disinformation about Venezuela. And in fact, some of the authors, if you can call them that, that they're publishing are completely uncredible people that belong to, you know, an extremist, ultra-right-wing opposition here in Venezuela, some of whom are based in the United States, no surprise, and who just, you know, invent all kind of fictitious information to try to portray the Chavez administration as a dictatorship and the country, you know, in a some kind of horrendous failing state. So I'm not quite sure what's going on at the Huffington Post, but I've sent them letters and comments and requests about, you know, what's going on in terms of their coverage and their selection on Venezuela. It appears as though there is, obviously, as there is in other, you know, mainstream and progressive media in the U.S., people that just choose, because of their own personal preferences, to publish disinformation and anti-Chavez articles. Even, you know, The Nation, which is known in the U.S. as very progressive, left-wing, even, if you could call it that, has published also disinformation, critical, manipulated, distorted information on Venezuela. They published a book last year, in fact, absolutely atrocious. And completely false book about Venezuela. The same thing, accusing Chavez of being a dictator and that the country is falling apart and, you know, this constant violation of freedom of expression and things like that. So, I mean, I wouldn't go so far as to say some kind of conspiracy, but I think that the disinformation campaign has been so effective in the United States that even thinking people, thoughtful people in the progressive community have assumed this position against Venezuela, and it's incredibly disheartening for those of us who are working against that, you know, very aggressive media campaign.
Well, it's not just disheartening, it's dangerous, because many people who don't really pay much attention think that sites like HuffPo and The Nation are progressive. And so if they get that their information from there, they must think that it's coming from a left-wing perspective. But I'm going to tell you a quick story about Arianna Huffington that might shed a little bit of light on what's happening over at the HuffPo. The first time that I met with President Chavez in January of 2006 at the World Social Forum, when I got back, I got summoned to a meeting with her, and she just like read me the riot act for meeting with President Chavez. She did tell me that he was very oppressive. She didn't use dictator, but a tyrant, and I shouldn't meet with him because it then undermines my message. And my message at that time was her message, and we need to elect more Democrats.
Well, yeah, unfortunately, that's the position that many people in the progressive community or the Democratic community have assumed. And obviously, I mean, she's the editor of that page, so there's really no question as to where the decision is coming from to publish just a slew of anti-Chavez. And, I mean, beyond just being critical of Chavez, I've seen them. I wade through just the horrible articles that I see posted on Venezuela and the Huffington Post. And I mean, beyond just critical, they're full of just all kinds of lies and distortions. And there's no alternative viewpoint presented. I mean, there's no accuracy going on. It's very relative and similar to what's going on at the Washington Post. I wonder if Arianna Huffington is in agreement with the Post coverage on Venezuela, which is an editorial decision made by Jackson Deal, who runs the editorial page, and he writes all those just, you know, horrid editorials and op-eds about Venezuela. And the one he wrote, in fact, just last week after the legislative elections here, was basically calling for an invasion of Venezuela. It was titled, "Is Hugo Chavez a Threat?" And what the entire editorial was dedicated to saying, yes, he is, and then the U.S. needs to do something about it. So, I mean, yeah, unfortunately, as is the case in many different areas of politics in the United States, the far right and the progressive, you know, left, whatever, center, come together when it's something that's convenient for their interests. And for some reason, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela seems to bring those two different spectrums together and in the U.S. and, you know, take a similar stance. And you're right, it's incredibly dangerous, especially when they're calling for aggression against Venezuela and they're lying in order to justify it. It reminds us of Iraq.
Have you ever run across in your work this is getting a little off the subject, but because I read the articles in the Huffington Post and then I look at the comments, and the comments I think are where I find a lot of the more interesting things. It seems like they're in Israel has some paid bloggers, and I think they call them the Internet Defense League or something like that. Do you think that that's happening in the opposition with Venezuela, that there are some people paid to go on and make comments like Hugo Chavez? They compare Palin and Chavez they want to make out that Hugo Chavez is some like doofus and he's stupid and he doesn't know what he's doing. But do you think that that's happening a little bit, that the opposition has paid bloggers to go? And because they make hundreds of comments, it's like, is that all you have to do all day is go and comment against Venezuela and against Chavez.
Right, and the same commentators appear on sites around the world. So I don't think there's any question there's a coordinated campaign. And I mean, it's a combination of factors. On one end, there's a domination of opposition forces in cyberspace against Venezuela because they generally tend to be the ones with more resources on just an individual level. You know, most of the opposition, that kind of diehard opposition, is generally upper class, wealthy, and has, you know, that kind of resource to be able to dedicate time to surfing through the web to comment on against Chavez on any possible article or blog. But there has also been, Cindy, over the past couple of years, a coordinated effort promoted by U.S. agencies, and particularly the Department of State, to select different opposition figures here in Venezuela, generally younger youth students, and train them in what now they're calling cyber dissidents. And in fact, just at the beginning of this year, in the spring, in April, the George W. Bush Institute, yes, it does exist, hosted a cyber dissident forum, and it was co-hosted with Freedom House and the Department of State, and they selected cyber dissidents from five countries. It was Venezuela, Cuba, Syria, Iran, and Russia. I think China, maybe it was six countries. China was there as well. And it was one person from each country, and basically they were trained by you know, representatives of Department of State and different U.S. agencies, Freedom House. George W. Bush presided over it, gave the opening speech, and they were given the skills and resources to then go back to their home countries and build what they call a cyber dissident network, you know, using blogs and Twitter and Facebook and MySpace and all the different initiatives online and technologies to wage a campaign against their government. So, yes, I definitely not just believe, but know and have documentation to show that the U.S. is funding these efforts to, you know, engage in a cyber war against countries like Venezuela, governments like Hugo Chavez.
How successful do you think that is? What kind of an impact does it have? Well, let's talk about the elections in Venezuela. What kind of an impact do you think that had on the elections and not just the cyber dissidents, but the money that the U.S. spends to give to the opposition in Venezuela to affect the elections?
Yeah, it had a substantial impact and influence. I mean, one, we're talking millions of U.S. taxpayer dollars, at least between 10 to 15 million coming out of USAID and National Endowment for Democracy, channeled through various agencies of the United States that funded political parties and the campaigns here. And, I mean, in the end, most of the opposition's campaign for the legislative elections was all through media. They had very little campaign that was visible in the streets. So, like obviously the Chavez camp campaigns are all over the streets, and you see the people, and they're out there, and I mean they're going door to door, and they're caravanning, and you see it, you smell it, you hear it, you feel it, you know. But the opposition campaign was pretty much behind the screen, either in cyberspace or on television, and that costs money, mm-hmm. and that money came from your taxpayer dollars, and yeah, it has a huge impact because it costs money, and they do really good campaigns. I mean, they're designed to attract younger voters particularly, and that's what really happened in this particular election, was that the Chavez camp didn't lose votes compared to the last elections, the regional elections that took place 2 years ago in 2008. Basically, the numbers stayed the same, but the opposition camp was able to mobilize more people, mainly in urban centers like Caracas, the capital, to come out to vote, and that was mainly done over the internet and through, you know, TV propaganda that in large part was paid for by U.S. taxpayer dollars and, you know, co-designed at least by expert political consultants and PR people from the United States. And so, yeah, I mean, it was very effective. They did a great campaign. I mean, if you look at it, you know, objectively, mm-hmm. they focused on just few issues very directly. The main issues were getting out to vote in order to obviously change the National Assembly, make the opposition have a majority. But beyond that, they made the whole campaign, it was pretty amazing to witness, to be an issue of communism versus capitalism. And their side, obviously, was capitalism, which they termed, Venezuelan democracy. And then, of course, what the current government is implementing, they call it communism. So, and actually, it wasn't just communism. It was Cuban, Castro-Cuban communism.
Right.
I mean, it was literally a regression to the Cold War. And there was no question that it had the U.S. fingerprints all over it, because it was like a typical U.S. campaign from 20 years ago that they used here. And it was effective because, unfortunately, it terrifies people. It scares them into thinking they're going to lose everything. They're going to take away your kids. They're going to take away your house. If you've got an apartment with two rooms, they're going to give one to some poor person, and you're going to have to share, and there's going to be rationing and things like that. And they scared people. And unfortunately, people are very easily swayed by, effective media campaigns. I mean, it was the same. I watched the whole thing, witnessed it, and analyzed it, and it was like sitting through also the elections in 2008 in the U.S. They sold a product. It was like the selling of Obama.
Right.
They sold the opposition coalition, which here is called MUD. Literally, that's their name, MUD. They sold the MUD.
Mm-hmm.
And, even though they didn't get the majority, they still got more votes than most people had expected.
Well, also in the Venezuelan constitution, it takes mostly 2/3 vote in the legislature, from what I understand, to get anything accomplished. And the opposition was able to take slightly more than 2/3 of the seats in parliament.
No.
I'm sorry.
That's
not 2/3. Yeah. They were slightly more than 1/3. so the People's Socialist Party doesn't have 2/3 of a majority. What kind of implications do you think that has with the program, the socialist program that President Chavez wants to implement in Venezuela?
It's actually not completely accurate to describe it that way, just because, I mean, I know that's initially, that was the goal set by the Chavez camp, and the PSUV party, his party, was to get the 2/3, because it would secure just this solid majority where they could do whatever they want. But by getting 60% of the parliament, they still have what's called the absolute majority. So they can push through most legislation. There are things such as approving Supreme Court justices require 2/3. So, if that comes up during the next term, then yes, they will have to somehow negotiate with the opposition forces. But basic legislation only requires absolute majority. Passage of the budget only requires absolute majority. International agreements only approving, treaties, things like that, only requires an absolute majority. So pretty much nothing will change in any kind of radical or substantial way. It's just more, I mean, what happened is that Chavez himself, has very high expectations, and so he put out the challenge to his campaign team to get the 2/3. And so when the 2/3 wasn't achieved, then it seemed as though there was some kind of defeat.
Right.
But it's actually not a defeat, because the PSUV party, his party, won 98 seats, I mean 60%. The opposition parties totaling won 65 seats, 67 if you include an independent leftist party. But within their coalition, they all ran on their individual party tickets. So they're not just, it's not like one party versus the other.
Right.
And when you break it down, the next party, like the second place to get a number of seats in the assembly, only got 22. So the PSUV party is 98, and the next in line has 22. That's why it's what's called an absolute majority. I mean, in the end, it will be reflected once the legislature takes the new body takes office in January 2011, because all those parties, there are 10 parties in that coalition, they don't agree with each other. They don't have similar agendas. Their only one point they agree on is that they hate Chavez.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to actually trying to do anything politically, they're completely divided. So it will, you know, that'll come through. I mean, they won't be a coalition in the assembly. And so, you know, there will be differences amongst them, and that will be reflected. But in the end, they can't, even if they all banded together with that 40% or their 65 or 67 seats, they can't even pass a law.
Right.
So, I mean, they definitely can't retract any laws or put a stop on anything. So it's not really going to have much of an impact. It's more of, you know, it's more sort of psychological that they're back, they're in there, and some of the candidates that won were key coup leaders
right.
8 years ago.
I wanted you to talk about
unfortunately,
that,
unfortunately, yeah, I mean, you know, what happened is that in 2007, in December, as most heads of state can do, I don't know if it's in the U.S., I can't remember if it's at the end of the year or at the end of their term, I think it's the end of each year, but can issue pardons. And what Chavez did, for a reason some of us do not comprehend, was in December 2007, as a gesture yet again of, you know, his reaching out to opposition forces here, he issued an amnesty or a pardon for everyone involved in the coup who hadn't committed crimes against humanity or been directly involved in assassinations.
Right.
And so all these people that were involved politically, that were out there, we saw them all, that shut down TV stations, that signed a decree dissolving all of the institutions in the country, ruining the democracy, trying to bring it all down. You know, they've been pardoned for all of that. So they were able to run for office. And so, yeah, I mean, many of them got elected. And what's most horrifying to me is that people would vote for them. But it's the situation in this country is just so dramatically polarized that there are people, or that there are people that just still, you know, are so fascist that they believe that coup against Chavez, which was going to kill him and resulted in the deaths of over 100 people, and if they had had their way and eventually hadn't been defeated within 48 hours, they would have killed pretty much everybody else that supported
mm-hmm.
Chavez.
Right.
But there are people that think that way. You know, there are people that still think that way today. I mean, I know it's not, it shouldn't be shocking to most people, but it still is hard to believe sometimes and comprehend that people can just be so horrible. And so, yeah, I mean, and actually two people ran, several people ran that are imprisoned, and they're not political prisoners. They're either corrupt or some of them have committed homicides that ran for office, and two of them won. And there's this whole crazy debate going on now about whether or not they get some kind of retroactive immunity, because now they're going to be, you know, they've been elected legislators, and so they get legislative immunity. But, I mean, it's, again, these are issues that go beyond my comprehension of how you can issue retroactive immunity to someone who's been already, you know, processed for crimes or convicted in some cases. And, yeah, now these are going to be the people in the parliament. I mean, representing Venezuelans, because in the end, they represent all Venezuelans, not just those that elected them.
Right.
And so, yeah, I mean, it's scary. And for me, it's been a reflection of, you know, the fact, one, that the right wing is definitely, that it's a backlash of the right wing, that you cannot ever see this face to these characters, because they're always there waiting to take back the space they had before and to take as much more as they possibly can, and that there's never any form of reconciliation with groups and politics that, you know, are founded on severe hatred and racism and classism and you know, violations of others, that they don't want to coexist. They want it all back for themselves. I mean, that's what this is really about.
Well, and I, from my observations, they were able to, first of all, get all those millions of dollars of funding from the United States, but also able to actually exploit conditions that really President Chavez had no control over: a drought, the horrible electrical infrastructure that he inherited from, you know, the years of the oligarchy, and then a global you know, financial crisis. So, you know, they were able to also exploit those
Yeah, it was actually one of the worst. Well, no, this was one of the worst years ever that mm-hmm. Venezuela had, and that the government had, and that wasn't caused by coups or, you know, external sabotages, because primarily because of that drought that lasted over 6 months. And oddly enough, Venezuela being this major oil producer, the country 75% dependent on hydroelectric energy because of the way, you know, governments passed, set up the whole infrastructure of the country. And so, yeah, with the drought, I mean, it was pretty severe. Had the government not implemented nationwide rationing of electricity, which was, you know, pretty heavy duty in terms of affecting people's lives. I mean, we all lived through it. We were less subject to it here in the capital just because of the massive chaos it would have caused. But nationwide, yeah, I mean, people were going hours daily without electricity, and then most of the water sources are pumped by electricity. So when your lights go out, your electricity goes off, you lose water as well. So you can imagine the impact that had on people's daily lives. And it wasn't the fault of the government. But and had they not implemented the rationing, then the country would have collapsed completely, which is what the opposition wanted. In fact, they headlined articles in their newspapers, you know, the main daily papers here, which are opposition-controlled, back in March, saying that the first week of May would be the entire collapse of the country, and that the government would never be able to you know, in any way resolve the electricity crisis, and everything would just be completely destroyed. I mean, that's what they wanted. Mm-hmm. And so when the government was able, through the rationing plan, which had a severe impact on everyone's lives, everything's fine now. Everything's back to normal. But of course, that was the majority of this year before the elections, and yeah, it affected people. And the same with the recession. We had a huge banking crisis. 11 banks went under here and were intervened by the state from December to February. I mean, and what this government did instead of backing the bankers was secure all of the savings of all the people. And most of those banks were either liquidated or nationalized. And the government, you know, paid people all their savings. I mean, but still, it had all this psychological impact on people. And then again, the economic crisis, even though it's not as severe here as it is in the U.S., we have a lower unemployment rate, for example. Mm-hmm. But still, you know, there's been inflation, as there is every year here, and the private businesses, they engage in a lot of speculative practices, and they hike up prices. And at the beginning of the year, currency here was devalued. And so, of course, again, that has psychological impact. So, yeah, I mean, I say it's amazing that the pro-Chavez party got 60% of the legislative body, considering all of this, you know, crisis that the country went through economically and just, you know, in people's daily lives throughout most of the year. And a lot of the reason why the votes weren't even higher for the Chavez camp were because, and it was in certain areas, were because in those areas they were the ones that were most subjected to rationing, for example. And they didn't feel like their local politicians responded to them in any kind of effective way that made them feel as though they were being heard. And even though many of those are, you know, politicians that are aligned with Chavez. So there's a big process going on here now. It's very interesting. It's very important of, you know, revising and reviewing and looking inward and self-criticism and seeing, well, what went wrong? What didn't the party do enough, or the government, or the revolution, and what needs to be corrected, and how, you know, how can we prevent this just, you know, completely ferocious right-wing anti-democratic from continuing to recuperate the power that they used to have in the country. So even though the government, the pro-Chavez party, didn't get the two-thirds majority they wanted, they have a comfortable majority to continue their policies, and it's been an important lesson in learning, you know, where things went wrong and what needs to be corrected. And I think for me, and being someone who's been involved and a witness and a participant in this revolution now for the past decade, that's one of the most admirable characteristics about President Chavez, is that he's willing to admit and take responsibility for his mistakes and his errors, even when he didn't directly commit them, but members of his government or his party have. Mm-hmm. And he's willing, you know, to engage and to call and to convene everybody into a collective process of self-criticism and, you know, figuring out ways through dialogue that things can improve and advance. I mean, that's really what revolution is about.
Well, and we're having elections coming up here before a month is out. And the Democrats are going to, I think, pretty much get creamed in these next elections. And they're not going to reflect on, you know, everybody wants us to be in solidarity with the Democrats, but nobody's saying, hey, the Democrats should be in solidarity with the people. And so what are the... You just talked about an inward reflection of what needs improvement with really, you know, 60% of the seats is still, like you said, a substantial majority, and with the opposition sat out the last election. So, you know, still a substantial majority. But what implications do you think that these elections have for the presidential elections in, I think, 2012?
That's right. 2012, the same as the U.S.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, I'm glad you pointed out that the opposition did boycott the last legislative elections 5 years ago, so they forfeited all their seats. So, but before that, in the 2000 election, they won almost 50%. I mean, they had about 80 some seats, and it was almost half. I mean, and so they've actually gone down in numbers. That's another important factor. And again, the PSUV party is a new party. It's only been in existence for 3 years, and the fact that it was able to win the largest number of seats that any one party has ever won before in Venezuela's history is an important sign that, yeah, and things are pretty much on track for 2012. Chavez has launched his pre-candidacy. And I mean, I think that it will be a difficult road, just because the opposition, they always feel after they get some minor victory, whatever you want to call it, in an electoral process, they puffs them up, and so they feel like they've conquered and they're ready to conquer the rest of it all, and so that's their position right now, and they think they're just barreling through it. Through 2012, and they're going to defeat Chavez, and they're banding together everywhere. And certainly there's going to be a massive investment from abroad, particularly right. The U.S., into the opposition's campaign. And some of them, I mean, one of the guys is already out there. I saw today he's meeting with heads of state in throughout Europe, already campaigning, an opposition guy who was also involved in the coup. And I mean, they're marking their ground. And we also have to look at, Cindy, this campaign, this very aggressive media campaign against Chavez, against Venezuela, is taking place right now. I mean, it's been intensifying. We talked about it last time. We talk about it every time.
Right.
We talk because it's ongoing. It's permanent. But just over the past few weeks, it's just been, you know, really, really violent. I mean, trying to make links between Venezuela and nuclear bombs.
Right.
You know, I mean, there's not even a nuclear ambition here at all. And then all these different links they're trying to make with terrorism from Colombia, or terrorism from Spain, or terrorism from Iran, or wherever, you know, from anywhere in the world to Venezuela, and drug trafficking, all these kinds of things that are unsubstantiated claims, but they're incredibly dangerous. And, you know, even that ridiculous incident that happened about 3 weeks ago in the U.S. when that couple was arrested, a couple of scientists,
right,
older scientists in New Mexico, and they had been duped or coerced into their arrest by an FBI agent pretending to be a Venezuelan official, who then coerced them into, you know, saying they'd sell nuclear secrets to build a bomb. But it had nothing to do with that. But, of course, all the headlines said selling nuclear secrets to Venezuela for
right.
a bomb.
Right.
I mean, but that thing, it's very scary because Venezuela has nothing to do with it. And yet, those are the headlines out there. And most people in the U.S. particularly know nothing about Venezuela. And so that's what sticks. And it's been a bombardment during the past 5 years, at least, of these negative concepts about Venezuela, and particularly about Chavez. And what's even more dangerous is making this kind of connection with the nuclear factor when the U.S. is on the verge of launching some kind of attack against Iran for the exact same reason. So, you know, it seems like they're trying to package Venezuela together with Iran.
Exactly.
And it's very frightening. And, yeah, I mean, I think this is going to increase as we get closer to 2012, because certainly Washington does not want Chavez to continue in power here. And I think that there are powerful interests in the U.S. and in other parts of the world that will do anything they possibly can to prevent Chavez from winning in 2012. But at the same time, I mean, there's no question that if the elections were today, he would win over with an overwhelming majority. His popularity is still above 60% in polls, and it's going to continue to grow because, you know, we're coming out of all the economic crisis and the electricity crisis. So things are getting back on track. There are new programs being implemented. There's a whole railway system that's being built that in a couple of years is going to be in place throughout part of the country. You know, it's going to change people's lives. I mean, projects and different policies of this government that are being implemented that have huge impacts on people that a lot of times people don't realize because it's their daily life, but their daily lives. But you know, I mean, it improves their quality of life. And people will see that. And they'll see, again, that the opposition has nothing to offer. They've never offered anything, and they have nothing to offer. They have no agenda. Their only agenda is getting Chavez out. So, you know, I think people get tired of that. And so, yeah, I mean, we're prepped for 2012 in that mode here, but it's still a road from here to there. And I think a lot of things are going to go down between now and then.
Well, it is, like we were saying before, very interesting times. Since Barack Obama's taken office, there was a successful coup in Honduras. And last week, there was an unsuccessful coup, but still, I don't think, Correa's out of the woods yet in Ecuador. But what do you think? Because, you know, we're always afraid that something's going to happen to Chavez because, you know, he always rises above. He rose above a coup attempt. He rose above a recall attempt that was financed by the United States. He rises above these challenges in his country, and, you know, because of the people and because of what he's doing is for the people and, you know, not for the oligarchy. But how do you think that the coup attempt last week in Ecuador kind of, goes along with the elections in Venezuela where the people were again victorious? And what kind of implications do you think that has?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's another example of this right-wing backlash and the fact that, you know, they think they got this small victory in Venezuela, and so they went for Ecuador, and it was actually the coup that took place that failed, that was thwarted by the popular support that Correa received. I think was, you know, took place too soon. The terrain wasn't prepped enough for it to work. And again, they're also riding on the victory of last year's successful coup in Honduras that was supported by the Obama administration and thinking they'll get the support as well because they're going to get someone out of office who's completely inconvenient to U.S. interests, who's a strong ally of Chavez. It will weaken and debilitate Chavez's influence in the region if Ecuador, you know, removes itself like Honduras did from ALBA and decreases its advance in social justice and things like that. And, I mean, yeah, it's incredibly, again, a scary incident. You know, I was just watching a few moments ago before we spoke another live interview with President Correa from Ecuador and him talking about, you know, the fact that it was an assassination attempt on his life. If they couldn't force him to resign like they did with Zelaya, he didn't resign, but they forced him out of the country. See, that was one of the main differences with Honduran President Zelaya. His kidnapping took place almost in the middle of the night, in the early morning hours, before anyone was up or before anyone could know. And by the time people found out, he was already forced out of the country. And so even though the people took to the streets and were out there, you know, for a long time, for months, still, he was gone. They couldn't get him back. And in this case, they didn't get to Correa fast enough, or at least they didn't, you know, they weren't able to complete their objective. All this evidence has been coming out about recordings of police over the police patrol walkie-talkies saying, kill him, kill him, kill Correa. He won't get out today, you know, kill the SOB. I mean, they wanted to kill him. And while this is going on, all these other political factions were beginning to move the pieces to execute the coup from the legislative body, sectors aligned with the right wing and with ex-president Lucio Gutierrez, who was one of the figures behind the whole coup. They were calling for a dissolution of Correa's government and for his forced resignation, and and then other elements, unfortunately, of different social movements, including progressive ones, including ones on the far left and indigenous movements that have connections. I have it documented to USAID and NED funding. They also, they put out declarations, communiques, calling for Correa's resignation on the early afternoon of the coup on Thursday, calling for his resignation, calling for a dissolution of Congress and all the institutions, and supporting the police and the other officials involved in the violent uprising that, you know, set the coup in motion. And so if it hadn't been for his rescue that in the end resulted in 10 dead and over 200 wounded, if special forces hadn't rescued him and the people hadn't taken the streets, and today he was saying it was over 100,000 people. I mean, we couldn't get the full picture from the images broadcast over Telesur, but yeah, I mean, he said it was pretty substantial, the popular support. And of course, the high military command stuck behind him, and that was one of the main concerns.
Yes.
But again, yeah, I mean, it's a coup. What's also really disturbing, Cindy, is the fact that most mass media questioned, not just on the day of the coup, but continue to question whether or not it was a coup. Some have even indicated that Correa invented it. There was some kind of self-kidnapping or self-coup to make himself more powerful. I mean, just It's repulsive that people can even think this way. But media like CNN, for example, continue to broadcast when they do stories on what happened last week, that it was just a police uprising, that it wasn't a coup. And even though the OAS met yesterday, the Organization of American States, and the Secretary General, who had just gotten back from Ecuador, said there's no question it was a coup, and that the people executing it thought that because it worked in Honduras, it would work there too. And just another, an anecdote here or a point of information that's important is that on the day of the coup last Thursday, all heads of state in South America mobilized and went to Buenos Aires, Argentina. For Chavez here in Venezuela, it took him almost 8 hours to get there to have an emergency meeting, which took place around midnight, to support Correa and to find some way that, South American nations could unite to help solve the situation in Ecuador. And heads of state from around the world expressed their support for him, issued declarations, called him. That was last Thursday. Well, 1 week later, which is today that we're recording this, President Obama called Correa to issue him his support. I mean, come on.
Right.
A week's gone by.
Mm-hmm.
The guy's safe now,
Right.
A week? It's just, I mean, that's just incredible. It's just another showing of the hypocrisy of the United States. And at the same time, the State Department wasn't even issuing any kind of condemnation about what was happening in Ecuador until almost every other country in this region had done so, very strongly. And the State Department wavered, just like they did in Honduras. It was a repeat. And
right.
So, yeah, I mean, I think
right.
it's a sign.
Right.
I think it's a sign that there are elements of, opposition, right wing, whatever, however we want to classify them, who will continue to behave this way and believe that they can achieve their goals via force, breaking all democratic rules because they have the support of prime elements and power interests in the United States. Because in the end, no matter how much Latin American integration has increased independence in this region, there are still a lot of political organizations and parties and interests and economic interests that still believe the U.S. is the dominant power. And so they will always look to the U.S. for guidance. And until the U.S. stops interfering and meddling and trying to impose its agenda here, these types of coups and undemocratic events are going to continue.
Well, we've been entrenched in South America, Central America, of course, for centuries. And it's, we're just very, our presence there is just very all-consuming. But it's a people's revolution against the U.S. presence there. And the governments down there can't very long ignore their people. But let's go back a little bit, because you said two things that I think are very important. And maybe my listeners don't exactly know what you were talking about. You said ALBA, I want you to tell my listeners what ALBA is and why it's so significant. And then you said NED, and that's also very significant. So I just want you to tell my listeners what those two things are.
Two polar extremes.
Yep.
ALBA, yeah. ALBA is the Bolivarian Alliance of the Americas, which was created in 2004, initially between Venezuela and Cuba, as a mechanism of cooperation and integration trade, but trade with a different face, with a human face. And then it expanded to include Bolivia and Nicaragua joined in. Honduras was in there briefly until Zelaya got overthrown. And Ecuador became a full member actually just last year, early 2009. I've been an observer nation for a couple of years. And then there are a few members in the Caribbean, Antigua and Barbuda, San Vincent and the Grenadines, and Dominica are members. And what ALBA does is basically provide a platform for a kind of humane and trade between these nations that's based on principles of solidarity, integration, and non-competition. So, and also mutual benefit. I mean, the idea is that whatever you have that I need, you trade to me, and I give you whatever I have that you need. So Venezuela's got a lot of oil, so Venezuela basically trades its oil for example, from Bolivia, soybeans and agricultural technology. With Ecuador, there's big agreements were signed last year for fishing and shrimp. They have a huge fishing industry and shrimping industry. And so to help Venezuela develop their technology, you know, this kind of in-kind exchange that's not about exploitation or competition. That's what ALBA is. And then again, most of the countries in ALBA, pretty much all of them, maybe with the exception of the Caribbean nations, because they're still dependent on primarily still on U.S. and international financing institutions, but most of them share a political vision, which is anti-imperialist, not anti-U.S., but anti-U.S. domination in this region, and a vision of Latin American independence. And so that's a key sort of, you know, pillar of ALBA, is that these are nations seeking their independence regionally and ways that they can help each other to develop and progress in a humane and prosperous way for their people, and not a way that's going to further enslave them or into misery and poverty like U.S. policies have done here for centuries. And of course, the U.S. doesn't like it because, yeah, they want to retain their hegemony in this region. And so they've been going after ALBA nations. Ecuador is the fourth ALBA nation that's been victim of a coup in the past 8 years.
Right.
It's been Venezuela in 2002, Honduras in 2009. Bolivia was victim in 2008, although it was also stopped by regional intervention and, you know, the people in Bolivia. It didn't get as far as Ecuador's did. And then Ecuador's this year. The NED is the National Endowment for Democracy. And it was created by the U.S. Congress by legislation in 1983. And it came out of the Reagan era and an initiative to find a way to continue work that CIA had been doing throughout, you know, the 20 years before, penetrating different civil society groups and political parties and labor unions and media outlets to fund them and recruit, you know, agents that would serve their interests. But they wanted to do it in a way that was much more legitimate, that had a happy face. They called it promoting democracy. And NED, the National Endowment for Democracy, after it was founded, was first used in Nicaragua to try to bring down the Sandinistas, and they did it effectively. After all those death squads and all that Iran-Contra scandal, none of that worked. You know, they killed tens of thousands of Nicaraguans and Central Americans in this dirty war led by the Reagan administration. It didn't work to bring down the Sandinistas, but NED's intervention did, because what they did was build what they like to call civil society coalition of organizations and unions and business groups and media and churches and political parties, bring them together, build an opposition, and, you know, basically destabilize society, the country, until the point where the people are just so exhausted of the conflict that they vote out the government in power. And in that case, it was the Sandinistas. And NED, after it had the success in Nicaragua, has now been working all over the world. They're in about 70 countries around the world, funding with U.S. taxpayer dollars. Their budget comes out of the foreign ops budget every year, so, and it's supervised by State Department. It's a U.S. agency, and they fund political groups and media and religious groups in different countries around the world that promote their agenda. And so they've been funding, they funded all the opposition groups here involved in the coup, and they increased their funding after the coup took place. I mean, as a basically saying, well, we didn't give you enough money, here's more.
Right.
Get that guy out.
Right.
Yeah, and so then there's evidence that they've been funding also groups in Ecuador that are against President Correa. It's no shocker. They funded the ones that were involved in the coup against Zelaya, and the separatist groups in Bolivia. Anywhere you look, where there's some kind of, where there's any kind of government that's not convenient to U.S. interests, you're going to find the National Endowment for Democracy working there to overthrow it.
And then we also...
With your taxpayer dollars.
Right. I was doing an interview with Father Roy Bourgeois from the School of America's Watch last Thursday. And that's when we were just finding out that some trouble was happening in Ecuador. And I read somewhere, I think today, that the leader of the coup in Ecuador was a graduate from the School of America's.
I don't know. We don't know yet who exactly were all the leaders, but
right.
One of the police chiefs that was involved in the uprising and then the assassination attempt. He's actually a colonel because Ecuador's police, it's a national police, and many of them are military. He's a colonel there in the police force, and he was trained at the School of the Americas. Yeah, that's the other, it's like the NED of the military. I mean, wherever you find coups taking place in this hemisphere, there will be officials trained at the SOA, at the School of the Americas, which is basically a death squad training camp.
Right.
And it's still there. I mean, it's incredible. It's still up and running.
Well, Father,
2010.
Well, Father Roy said, too, that President Correa is trying to purge, you know, the military of those, but I don't think you can do it that fast because they have
it's
a lot
very
of power.
Difficult. I mean, yeah. The Venezuelan coup also against Chavez, the key generals involved were all School of the Americas trained, all of them. And basically, I mean, the ones that most of them then fled justice and are in Miami in the U.S. protected by the U.S. government.
Right.
But the others that remained in the military here have just, basically what the Chavez government has done is just wait until their time comes to retire them out. There's nothing more you can do. And Chavez cut off all the military exchange with the U.S. in 2005. And that included beyond just School of the Americas. There's all kinds of military training, education programs that State Department and Pentagon run in countries around the world, and it's another mechanism for training and placing agents that will then serve U.S. interests in military forces. So Correa was talking about it today, about how he's trying to humanize the police force, and he needs to get these, he called them fascists, out of the military and the police. But yeah, it's a process. It takes time, and you have to train a whole new force. That's the other part of it, is who's going to replace them? I mean, their police force is 42,000 officers, and not all of, only he said under 1,000, if that, were involved in the coup. So that's he made a point of saying, look, it's not, most of our police come from poor neighborhoods, and they're not, they're the people in the country, they're from the communities, and we can't demonize the police force because they were manipulated by certain factors and sectors within them that are, connected and managed by external sources and powers. These are major processes taking place here in Latin America that are incredibly difficult and complex and take a long time. They've got to purge out all these poisons that have been injected and contaminated these societies and cultures for decades. I mean, even culturally, the U.S. influence is just everywhere. And to change that, it's an educational process. It's going to take time. It's going to be generations before things will change. And that's why it's so important that a majority of people back these processes, because they're not easy. There's no quick solution. It's not about instant gratification. It's about hard work and looking to the future for the time when things will be different.
Well, Eva, thank you so much for being on the show today. Is there anything else you want to tell my listeners?
Just to look for alternative sources of information on Venezuela and Latin America than what you get in mainstream media. Most of it out there is pretty distorted. And also, you know, think twice, whatever you read from any source about anything, but in this case about Venezuela or South America, the disinformation campaign has a very clear objective of trying to justify aggression against these nations. And the only way that we can prevent that from happening is by shedding light on the truth and having people understand what's really going on so that they won't allow their country to engage in aggression against friendly democratic nations that are just trying to pursue their own destiny. So, yeah, I would suggest people look for alternative sources of information. You know, stay tuned to Cindy Sheehan's soapbox.
And when my movie comes out, Revolution, A Love Story, you'll get a more balanced view of it. But also, I want to really congratulate and thank Telesur and Al Jazeera last week for their live coverage of what was happening down in Ecuador. I mean, Telesur, I just couldn't understand what they were saying. So we switched over to Al Jazeera, and they had Telesur's footage, but they had an English translation, which was immensely helpful.
That's right. And as you said that, I'll just say one last point of information. This week, just a couple of days ago, the president of the Board of Broadcasting Governors, the BBG, which is a State Department entity that runs Voice of America and State Department media, gave a speech saying that Telesur and other media like Russia Today, RT, and Press TV from Iran are enemy press of the United States.
I heard that.
And that the U.S. needs to be more active in the information sphere in order to combat the enemy press. That's pretty amazing.
But
Telesur is doing an astonishing job. And it's not enemy press. It's just getting real information out there, what the State Department doesn't want you to know.
And then just give your blog site out to my listeners one more time, because I gave it out before.
Definitely. Okay, www.chavezcode.com, and you can also follow me on Twitter at Eva Gollinger, spelled, I guess, Eva Gollinger.
Right, EVA. Well, thank you. And we were following your Twitter feed, too, and we had quite a lively conversation going on Facebook during the coup. So I think if we stick together, we might be able to do it.
Unity is the best defense against aggression.
Well, thanks so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, Ava. We'll talk to you soon, I hope.
Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. As usual, I'd like to thank my engineer, Scott, my webmaster, Rich, you for listening, and our guest, Ava.
I must make my witness. Have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad.
protest. I don't want you to ride. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
They're yelling in Baton Rouge.